This is the Cato Daily Podcast for Thursday, September 26, 2019. I'm Caleb Brown. The House has begun a presidential impeachment inquiry. What will it look like? How might it compare to impeachment proceedings in the past? Gene Healy is author of the recent Cato paper, Indispensable Remedy, The Broad Scope of the Constitution's Impeachment Power. He comments.
As best as you can tell, why has Nancy Pelosi chosen now to begin potential impeachment proceedings?
Yeah, well, up until this week, she'd been a major speed bump for anybody pushing towards impeachment. She thought, you know, the polls showed that it wasn't very popular. She was worried about Democrats in Trump-favorable districts, but the ground seems to have shifted under her. A number of Democratic members in those vulnerable districts have come out in favor of impeachment in the wake of this, you know, these revelations about this July 25th phone call with the Ukraine's newly elected president. This really seems to have moved a substantial number of the Democratic caucus into the pro-impeachment camp.
So, when we're trying to evaluate exactly what the smoking gun is or anything like that, what did this call between President Trump and the newly elected president of Ukraine, what did they actually discuss?
So the allegation that we first started hearing about recently involved this July 25th phone call with President Zelensky of the Ukraine. And the story was that President Trump was holding hostage almost $400 million in foreign and military aid in order to get the Ukraine to investigate Joe Biden and Joe Biden's son. In other words, with Joe Biden, his likely opponent for the 2020 presidential campaign. That moved a lot of Democrats off the fence and seems to have pushed Speaker Pelosi to make the announcement this week that the House was, quote, moving forward with an official impeachment inquiry. It's not clear that there's going to be a vote of the full House, as there was in the Clinton and Nixon impeachments, to start the impeachment inquiry, but she's at least using the adjective official and no longer seems to be throwing herself bodily in front of the impeachment train. And the next day, President Trump released a transcript, what purports to be a transcript of the call, from notes from contemporaneous notes from national security personnel that were in the Situation Room and also on the call. Now, the document we have does bear out Trump's insistence that there was no explicit quid pro quo on the call. He didn't say, you know, you better hammer the Biden family or there'll be no money for you or anything like that. The rest of it, though, is, you know, not great. It doesn't look squeaky clean. The president does mention, in the context of this discussion, there's a lot of talk about Biden's son, that Biden stopped the prosecution, this Ukrainian prosecutor general that Biden apparently got fired during his time as vice president, says, you know, it would be great if, you could look into that. On top of that, even if there is no quid pro quo per se in the record of the call that we have, there has been this sort of O.J. Simpson, if I did it vibe to some of the president's denials about a quid pro quo. I mean, he actually said to reporters at the UN, he said that there was no quid pro quo, but quote, I think it probably possibly would have been okay if I did impose that condition on aid. this is, you know, let's stipulate that presidents use foreign aid as carrots and sticks quite regularly. This, however, is at least the allegation is the holdup of foreign aid on the basis of requesting an investigation into your leading political opponent. That does put you in somewhat different territory than the norm.
What does the Constitution say about impeachment? I know you and I have discussed this many times, but it probably bears repeating.
Well, it's impeachment is a broad remedy for serious misconduct that demonstrates unfitness for high office, unfitness to wield powers. People find that, the breadth of high crimes and misdemeanors somewhat frustrating. Hamilton described it as, aiming at the abuse or violation of some public trust and said it couldn't be tied down by the sort of strict rules that you find in the criminal law. And people find the enormous gray area there frustrating, is particularly if they support the particular president that is in the crosshairs at any time. But it really had to be designed that way. There was no way that you could enumerate like an impeachment code of offenses that would indicate that somebody should be impeached and removed for offices, from a particular office. The human imagination is not that broad. It would be like trying to enumerate all your rights. So they left it somewhat open-ended and capacious deliberately. And I think it's difficult to say that in this case, that an inquiry isn't justified. The three categories we've of impeachment cases we've had in our constitutional history. This is from a report that the House Judiciary Committee did during the Nixon era. There's generally three broad categories: abuse of power, corruption, use of the office for corruption or personal gain, and a catch-all that's behaving in a manner grossly incompatible with the proper function and purpose of the office. And arguably, all three are at least alleged here. Imagine if, Hillary Clinton was still serving as Secretary of State during the 2016 campaign, and she leaned on a foreign government to investigate Donald Trump's finances. If the shoe was on the other foot, it's really difficult to see Republicans accepting "move along, there's nothing to see here" as an answer.
In at least the case of Richard Nixon, when impeachment articles were drawn up, there were three of them, but they listed several specific claims about the president. Is there any reason to believe that articles of impeachment drawn up by the U.S. House would be limited to this event, this phone call, and the events surrounding it?
We seem to be pretty far from articles that the full House is going to vote on at this stage, and it could go either way. At the end of this process, the strategy could be for them to focus on one particular salient example, something like this, the phone call with the Ukrainian president, or it could be more of a Nixon style articles that include the three articles of impeachment for Nixon were obstruction of justice, abuse of power, and resisting lawful inquiries for information from Congress and other bodies. And yes, they included quite a bit of detail. They could end up going either way with this. There have been articles that have been introduced during the first 2 years of Donald Trump's presidency that have pretty much died in committee. But some of them have have included quite a bit of detail and ranged further than, say, the obstruction of justice charges that came out of the Mueller report. So it's difficult to tell at this stage, you know, if we get to that point, what those articles are going to look like. But it seems certain that Ukraine Gate or Ukraine Ghazi or whatever you want to call it is going to be part of any such articles.
Presuming that Nancy Pelosi has spent more than a little bit of time thinking about this and how to proceed with an impeachment inquiry, what are the next steps that would be most prudent?
Well, I'm not giving her strategy advice.
Well, I mean, if she were clearly interested in getting to the bottom of this and making this a fairly honest process, what would the steps be?
Well, you know, those are two different inquiries. I would say that, you know, what's happened in our more recent presidential impeachments is that it's gone to the House Judiciary Committee, and the House Judiciary Committee has settled on some articles. They considered two additional articles that they didn't pass in the Nixon case and two additional articles they didn't pass in the Clinton case. That's what the process has looked like in the modern era. And, you know, but there's nothing that requires the House to follow that process. The Constitution's pretty spare about what has to happen procedurally in the House, other than that the House has the sole power of impeachment and that it's done by a majority vote. I think one aspect of what she of her announcement of a quote-unquote official impeachment inquiry it doesn't change that much. She sort of added the adjective official to it, but there's not going to be a preliminary vote by the full House to authorize the inquiry, you know, as there was in the Nixon and Clinton impeachments. And in part, that's because they don't need it as much as they did in the Nixon impeachment inquiry, because the Judiciary Committee already has subpoena power. It didn't in before that vote in the Nixon inquiry. But it's also in part probably because this way, at least so far, this might save members in vulnerable districts from having to stand to be counted on a vote for an impeachment inquiry that's prior to a vote on an actual articles of impeachment. So I think what's changed is she's no longer standing headlong in the way of something called an impeachment inquiry, but you know, it hasn't changed that much substantively.
I think there's a concern about people who take the impeachment process seriously, but like you, believe that it should be considered, if not outright used, more often. That if the House fails to take up this, in taking up this inquiry, they ultimately fail to end up at either impeachment or conviction, that harms the institution of impeachment. Do you think that's true?
It would be pretty tough to harm the institution of impeachment at this stage. You know, we've had three, in 230 years of our constitutional history, we've had only three really serious efforts to impeach a president. You know, if anything, we're in danger of this muscle never being exercised. And I don't buy the argument that unless you know that you've got the votes to convict in the Senate, it's completely it's a fool's errand to go, you know, down the road of an impeachment inquiry. I mean, it was anything from anything but a sure thing that Richard Nixon would be forced from office at the beginning of the impeachment inquiry after Watergate. Moreover, I think anybody that tells you that they know how this cashes out politically is kidding you or themselves or both. I don't think that it's said a lot of times that you know, the impeachment effort against Bill Clinton was a disaster for the Republicans. And, you know, they lost some seats in a midterm election, but they ended up controlling the holding all three branches of government in the next election. So not a total disaster. Gerald Ford almost came pretty close to winning the 1976 election and after the Nixon impeachment, and probably would have if he didn't pardon Nixon. So I don't think there's a lot of grounds for confidence about how all this plays out politically. It's different than the Clinton case. Bill Clinton was an overwhelmingly popular president at the time that the House GOP decided to impeach him. You know, part of this may be what comes out of this may be some collateral damage to Joe Biden's reputation. I think it's very premature to try to say how this all shakes out. But I would say that you know, this process is there for a reason, and I think the framers didn't want it used as regularly as, say, you know, we do government shutdowns these days. It wasn't supposed to be an ordinary weapon of political combat, but it was a safety valve. It was something that you'd need to use from time to time. I think they might be surprised that, you know, at our current rate, it's only like 1 in 15 presidents are impeached might be considered too infrequently. Like I said, this is a remedy that's there for a reason, and it's a muscle that ought to be exercised from time to time. You know, unless you know, so it doesn't fall into disuse.
Gene Healy is a vice president at the Cato Institute and author of the recent Cato paper, Indispensable Remedy: The Broad Scope of the Constitution's Impeachment Power. Subscribe to the Cato Daily Podcast wherever you get your podcasts and follow us on Twitter @CatoPodcast.